during a time of crisis, investors return to prior behaviors, prior practices, and they become actually less innovative and less interested in doing things differently and in new ways. And really, what has to happen in venture in order for it to succeed going in the future, you know, a future that includes women, a future that includes people of color, a future that includes innovation outside of Silicon Valley. In order for it to move into that future, it really must completely tip on its head its model, because the issues are societal. They're not specific to venture.
And now, from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast with your host, Christine Winoto.
Our guest today is Sharon Bosnak, CEO of Astia and Managing Director of the Astia Fund. Astia is a global organization that works to level the investment playing field for startups founded and led by women. A renowned speaker, Sharon has spoken at the United Nations and many universities about building inclusive ecosystems in entrepreneurship. Her approach and the approach of Astia is to lead by example. Their mission is to create lasting change in the venture capital sphere by investing in companies with women in positions of power. Here's our conversation. Sharon, thank you so much for joining me today. I've been following Astia for a while, and so far it's so nice to finally get connected to you and have you here on our podcast. And I thought it would be interesting to start from your background. You had quite a bit of experience. You were a senator aide, and now you're running Astia and founded Astia. But like, what brought you to where you are today?
Great question. Christine, thank you so much for the conversation today and inviting me to participate in your series. I'm always grateful for these opportunities to talk about entrepreneurship and Astia and how we fit into the investment landscape. I'm actually not the founder of Astia. I'm the fourth executive. It's part of my journey, but I'm not the only part of its journey. But my journey to Astia was actually quite circuitous. In hindsight, it makes a lot of sense. As you mentioned, I started my career working for a U.S. senator and really thought that that would be my path. And watching the debates right now is absolute joy for me. I know everyone else is miserable, but I'm watching them because I'm a political junkie at heart. But along the way in that work, I had the opportunity to go to American Express for a short period of time and really learned about some opportunities in global business and women's participation in finance in particular, and decided to return to graduate school focused on economics and public policy. And it was at graduate school that I developed a really keen interest in exploring women's participation in what I call positions of power, equity, and influence. It was after graduate school that I met the founder of Astia, and I had finished studying primarily microenterprise as a solution that was working for getting women into the economy and a solution for getting economies to function more efficiently and at a higher return for both communities and the individuals within it. But then I met Kate and I learned that only 2%, actually at the time, 1.2% of venture capital was being invested into companies that were led by women. And I must say that the academic in me got very excited. The economist in me was disappointed because clearly that is an inefficient and actually non-functioning, completely unfunctioning market that, you know, when you look at the percentage of women who are driving innovation versus those who are receiving capital, it's just a broken market completely all the way around. So I got quite excited by the academic exercise of learning about venture capital, learning about high growth entrepreneurship, and then in particular, learning about the opportunity to really solve for the lack of funding that was finding way into innovative women. That was 2003 when I first met the founder. Fast forward to 2020. And today, I am CEO of Astia. I'm also a managing director of the Astia Fund. and I am an active member of ASTIA Angels, and I am firmly committed, even more so today than ever before, to really solving for this broken space that we call venture capital, mm-hmm. and really doing it in a way that has impact for not only the companies we invest in, but broadly for the market.
You mentioned earlier about the numbers of ventures that invested in women, or number of women in the ventures. What do you think caused that? And what are the trends that you see now? And how hopeful should be towards more balance?
Well, let me answer the last part first. The trend is going the wrong direction. We're at a three-year low. PitchBook put out its new numbers today. Three-year low. But it's not unexpected, because when you look at the causes behind it, it actually makes a lot of sense that during a time of crisis, investors return to prior behaviors, prior practices, and they become actually less innovative and less interested in doing things differently and in new ways. And really, what has to happen in venture in order for it to succeed going in the future, you know, a future that includes women, a future that includes people of color, a future that includes innovation outside of Silicon Valley. In order for it to move into that future, it really must completely tip on its head its model, because the issues are societal. They're not specific to venture. Men and women are still in separate business networks. 98% of what I'll call the real power brokers in venture capital, those with substantial equity as well as salaries within venture firms, you know, that equity is really where the opportunity is, are white men. So you can naturally understand why there might be some friction in capital moving to women just because of who controls the capital. Add to it the methods of venture, and they reinforce those networks and that network problem. Most VCs firms won't look at a deal, as they call it, over the transom. They require introductions. Introductions rely on networks. Networks flow across gender, and they're very homogeneous, right? Right. We're not heterogeneous in our networks from a business perspective. And so you can see how that creates friction for what I'll call the non-white entrepreneur, non-white male, non-white, non-male entrepreneur. You know, so its means and methods, as well as its own representation, are the fundamental problem in venture. Add to it, I'm going to add another layer. In society, and U.S. economy specifically, women and people of color have had access to less capital than men. And what I mean by that is we have fewer friends and family rounds that we can raise. Most venture firms require a friends and family round seed investment. Once again, yet another mechanism that further mutes the ability of capital to flow from venture firms into these entrepreneurs of color and entrepreneurs who are women. So all of these things have to be shaken up. We don't need more women GPs. We need to eliminate the network effect, or at least greatly manage for it, right? We got to get beyond our own personal networks. And then we have to add to it what I'm going to call real social justice endeavor. You know, venture doesn't talk about social justice much, but I think at this moment it might be more okay than ever before. Mm-hmm. The requirement of this seed or friends and family round has got to be reevaluated. We see time and again early stage opportunities to invest in women and people of color where they focused on the customer rather than a seed, you know, a friends family round. So they have revenue coming in, and they've grown the business through that revenue. Either that, or they've raised that friends and family round, but it's been via 90 investors. They've pulled in, you know, small amounts here and there. Once again, that would be a warning flag for a VC. They don't want that many other investors. But we need some of these, what I'll call social justice initiatives, right? And a willingness to look at the deal differently, to look at how that deal came to us differently, and a willingness to look at the alternative types of companies, company structures as it relates to their investors, in order to be able to really embrace what is the future, which is a future that includes entrepreneurs of color and women.
So you mentioned about how, you know, the way the networking, like how to get the deal, need to change. How do you influence that change when majority are still in that, you know, why do they need to change?
It's a really good question, because affecting change at the level we're discussing, which is really a societal change, takes time and commitment. It's why Astia at age 20 is still, I would say, just now hitting its stride. You know, as I mentioned, I joined in around 2003, first as an advisor and then as COO. And along the way, we've learned a lot. And we've made sure to learn a lot. I think that was really critical. We tracked everything we tried. You know, we would try something. I called Astia our social experiment. We would try something. We'd measure the results. And what we've learned are a few really important things. Around our 10-year anniversary, we learned that, well, let me back up, actually, because we had learnings before that. So at each stage, I mentioned that we did some learning. And Astia started as a physical incubator. We then transitioned to a virtual accelerator. And today we're an investment house, all under a nonprofit. Each step, very intentional. When we started as a physical space, what we learned and the reason we transitioned away from that was that the entrepreneurs really didn't need physical space. That wasn't a differentiator for them. More importantly, when Stanford wrote its first business case about us, thank you, Tom Kosnick, the professor who did that, we learned when he interviewed the venture community that they actually perceived if these entrepreneurs needed physical space, they probably weren't worth investing in, right? They weren't going to be successful entrepreneurs. Even though they love getting deals from incubators, an incubator that was focused on women was perceived as sub-market. So we got rid of the physical space because it was harming our entrepreneurs. A few years later, we started looking at our lexicon, the language that we use. A key learning was when we switched from the word mentor to advisor. So we moved from mentoring companies to advising companies. Overnight, our funding success rate for the companies we were working with doubled. We went from a 30% funding success rate to a 60% funding success rate within 1 year of joining Astia by doing one simple thing, changing a word. Mentoring someone has a hierarchy. There's an implied hierarchy, right? Add to it gender, you've got a double hierarchy. But advisor, you know, because you're at UCSF, academically speaking, someone may be your advisor today as you're getting your PhD, and then suddenly they're your peer when you're doing all sorts of research. So switching that word matters. And then at year 10, we took a look at how our companies were performing. And we had top quartile performance. If we had been a venture fund at that time, the companies that qualified for Astia had top quartile performance. But the investment community still wasn't seeing a need to invest in those companies. So while we touched the company, it was going to be successful. But if we didn't, we hadn't moved the venture market. So it was then that we decided that our real work needed to be focusing on investment, because venture was not moving, even if we showed them the best deals. What we needed to do was be in the cap table as peers with them. This is our current thesis, in order to be able to get them to change behavior. Now, what I will share is that fast forward, we've been investing now since 2013. We have done just over $26 million in investments into 54 companies. We continue to see that top quartile performance. Our investment, we've returned capital to investors. We've had four phenomenal exits with above market returns. One of them in the med device space, I like to highlight, and Vision. Actually, two of them, CL Medical is the other one. And the reason that we're now raising a venture fund is because of that performance. Those deals were done as deal-by-deal capital calls with a network of LPs. So we're raising our first proper venture fund, a $100 million fund. And the reason we believe we need to be that VC, today our theory is the only way we're ever going to affect change is by moving these companies forward. And what they need to move forward is investment. There are a lot of programs that will mentor companies, a lot of support out there for women. And there's even a lot of investment at the edges, but there is not what I'd call a real focused effort to change the market through investment. And so that's what we are today. We're very singularly focused, all things capital. So we have a network of 5,000 advisors around the globe that help us source, screen, and sift the companies that we choose to invest in. But at the end of the day, our goal is to invest in the best-in-class companies. And that's how we plan to change the world.
Yeah. I mean, you make it sound so simple when you say when you change the word from mentor and advisor, you see the difference. but I'm sure there's underlining meaning to the change of the word in terms of how you give that impression to the company. I mean, what is the change?
Yeah. Well, I guess another important learning along the way in one of the business cases was that, because there were four of them written by Professor Kosnick about Astia. One of the key learnings was that if you confront people with a reality or with a truth that's different than their perception of reality, they become further entrenched in their perception instead of becoming a believer in the truth. So when I highlight that we simply change the word, that's truly all we did. The behavior is identical. What those advisors do with companies is they mentor them as much as a mentor would at any accelerator or incubator. But what it did was it created a dynamic, a kind of a peer structure that was new and different. So the change became organic change rather than what I call lecturing change, right? It wasn't that I stood up in front of them and now you'll be an advisor rather than a mentor. We really just allowed the community that Astia is, or the ecosystem, better word is probably ecosystem, less community, more ecosystem. We allowed the ecosystem to embrace the value that's embedded in that notion of advisors. In parallel, we launched our own initiative to be global, because as it relates to women in economies, if you look at how women and where women have been successful at participating in economies, it is where it's been within a global context rather than local. And I'll highlight just a few examples for you. Entrepreneurship is one of them. Anu Bhadwaj did some academic research. She's a Fulbright scholar to look at where women in high growth entrepreneurship succeeded. Often the most common denominator between those entrepreneurs were that they had access to a global network, either a network that was their alumni network, or it was a network from the business, the sales network, but it was something that allowed them to identify not just as the local. Locally, we are mothers, sisters, daughters, caretakers. We're the social safety net. Globally, we can redefine as entrepreneur and leader. So that was critical as well. Our behavior changed so that our ecosystem was no longer local. It embraced the global. Another example of where women succeed more effectively globally is if you look at financial markets globally, like the IMF. The head of the IMF is a woman. It's not lost on me that she's a woman. And one of the reasons I believe is that she can be a woman and successful as the head of the IMF because it's global. If you look more locally, there are very few women who are heads of banks. I'm really excited Citibank now has a female CEO. And that is earth-shattering to most, I think, within financial services, because most banks function more locally than what I'll call the quasi-governmental ones like the IMF that function globally. But we're only just now starting to see that locally women can succeed as what I'll call the head of and those power brokers. There's still that double bind for women, the perception of women more locally. So, you know, all of this is the work that we do at Astia. You can see how we're more than a venture firm because we have to think about these things. We have to embrace different approaches. We have to use different language, and language matters in these endeavors, because we can never just stand up in front of someone and lecture them about companies led by women outperform, which they do. Can't say inclusive teams outperform, which they do. We can't say innovation thrives when you have inclusion, which it does, because someone hearing that doesn't react generally, an investor hearing that doesn't react positively. Instead, they do as the venture community has done just now. They retrench back to old practices and old behaviors and old beliefs.
Yeah. And I think also on the news with the pandemic, they were seeing the numbers of women leaving the workforce as well, because the responsibility of childcare usually land on the women more than on men.
But that's not changed in entrepreneurship. So if you look at the female entrepreneur, I'm going to call her the phenotype. If you just look at what she generally is, she's on average 40 years old with two children, and she's often the primary, I'm going to call it custodian of the children, childcare, right? She's not necessarily the only childcare provider, but she's the one who figures it out. Mm-hmm. And that's not new. Even, I mean, I get what has happened post-pandemic with women leaving corporate America, very different than entrepreneurship. We're not seeing women leave entrepreneurship. Quite the opposite. We're seeing the numbers of women in entrepreneurship rise. And I think it's in large part due to this phenomena that you, when you can fiercely determine your own path forward, as you can with entrepreneurship, mm-hmm. you run after it in moments like this, right?
Right. And you can control your schedule a little bit more too.
And you can set the cultural norms, right? If you're the founder of a company, you get to determine what are the values within the company? How do you value flexibility? I'm not even going to call it work-life balance because it's not balance. Let's be honest. None of it's balance. It's all about the how do you accommodate being a human and being a founder of a company? And the fun thing is what we've learned in our 20-year journey is that entrepreneurs are phenomenal at creating culture within their companies that can embrace their humanness and their entrepreneurial desires.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Rudnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that help life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownrudnick.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Canon Quality Group. Canon Quality Group has been helping medtech startups set up quality management systems for over 10 years. If you're unsure when to get started with quality management in your startup, turn to the experts at canonqualitygroup.com.
And then what's really interesting in a COVID environment, and apologies, but I get very excited about COVID and what it means for our entrepreneurs, because I do believe entrepreneurs and innovators are what are going to drive us out of this current crisis, this health crisis, the economic crisis, the social crisis, all of it is going to be led by entrepreneurs. What we see is that our entrepreneurs are just as relevant post-COVID as they were pre, because we tend to invest in innovators who were already addressing a real and important problem. And when a pandemic hits, those problems don't go away. They actually become all the more pressing and all the more real. And so post-COVID, as we look at our portfolio, most of the companies they took the first month to figure out what is their response to a new environment and a new market and potentially new customers or new that was. But then after that month, they took off again because they were solving for real problems in a real world. And post-COVID, they're even more needed than before.
Yeah. And I know when sometimes people think Astia is investing in a women-led, but actually it's broader than that, like not just about women founder. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, I love talking about the more. So from the moment I joined Astia, back when we had 20 mentors, now advisors, it was half men and half women. Always have been. And that meant also that the companies we were serving, we were looking for companies that had women in positions of equity and influence. We weren't looking for women only, and we weren't looking at all for women in a specific role. As a matter of fact, many of our companies, the woman is the chief technology officer or the chief scientific officer, or she's the innovator as it relates to the business, but she may not be the CEO, and that is fine as long as she's in a position in that cap table and going to see the financial upside of the business, and she's at the table driving strategy. Because that's where we as investors see the real benefit. When she's helping, when she's participating, when she's part of the dialogue that leads to how the business grows, we see phenomenal performance and we see above market returns. So I actually really appreciate you asking that question and highlighting. And then as we look at our investor base, half men and half women within the direct investor community, as we look at our LPs, it's corporations, men and women within those corporations who have chosen. Our lead investor for the fund is MasterCard. Interestingly, our first toe in was the then chair of the board, Walt McKinney. Sorry, I was forgetting his name. Walt Mann within MasterCard. And he said, MasterCard needs to care about this. And then right behind him, Ann Cairns and Martina, the CFO, came in and got to know Astia, dove in deep, looked at our performance and made the decision based upon performance. But Ajay, the CEO, part of the discussion, you know, really it's men and women together that get this work done. More importantly, it's men and women together and inclusion of all sorts that achieves the higher return and the higher result. It's just the venture is still stuck in its model of white male phenotype, and they're really struggling to get out of it.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I like the approach is that it takes men and women to bring more of this equal, because it's not just a men's problem or a women's problem. You mentioned that, you know, many of the women-led or women-influenced company turn out to be outperforming. And is there a certain trait of that women have, I mean, that make it higher chance to be more successful?
Well, I think it has to do with inclusion more than women ourselves. However, do not discount what women uniquely bring. Inclusion means you figure out how to embrace what women uniquely bring. And I mean inclusion, not diversity. Diversity matters, but inclusion, organizations that figure out how to embrace the intellect, what I'll call the full contribution of its many and varied individuals, those inclusive organizations will consistently outperform. And much of ASTIA's thesis, the work we do, the foundation of what we do is built on research that we learned about out of MIT that looks at the performance of teams. And Professor Malone is the professor there who took a look at group intelligence. And we first became familiar with his work after we had already embraced the notion of men and women together. But it was really important validation of our anecdotal evidence. You know, we were seeing this higher performance when men and women together. And then we learned of Professor Malone's research. And what he did is he looked at the intelligence or IQ of teams. You know, we had known about individual IQ, which individuals in it, IQ. We had known about IQ for 40 years or whatever. You know, we knew how to measure individual intelligence. And there was a real number associated with that, measurable. And you could measure it across, you know, cultures and people and all sorts of things. Well, he sought to measure team intelligence similarly, and he found three consistent indicators for higher group IQ. And what he was specifically looking for, because he's at MIT, is what types of teams do you need in order to innovate? And the first thing he found was that how well the group dialogued with each other determined what the group IQ. So if they talked rather than shouting, they had a higher group IQ and a better subsequently a higher likelihood of succeeding in their innovation. Next item was how well did the group intuit each other's body language? So even though this is being recorded, you and I are looking at each other, we're reading each other's signals. I can tell when you're interested. I notice when I go on too long. These are important parts of group intelligence. And so that was a key indicator. And then the third item that was really profound and a key learning was how many women on the team. And the more women on the team, the higher the group IQ. Now, subsequent to the research, he's done it over and again across all sorts of different groups and methods and continues to validate that more women on the team leads to a higher group performance and higher innovation. I don't know that that's so much about women as how we socialize women. We socialize women to do those first two things I mentioned. We dialogue rather than shout. You know, we want people to like us, so we learn early. We saw it last night in the debate with Kamala Harris, you know, smiling and challenging the vice president to let her finish her sentences. So we know how to do this because we're socialized to do it. So I think because we socialize men and women differently, having women on a team leads to this higher performance. And I don't think it's genetic. I think it's socialized. Add to it women's relationship to money. So there's Professor Malone's research that validates having women on. But then add to it to the research that I've looked at as women relate to money differently. When women are given money, they take care of home and community. And, you know, their dollar tends to go much further towards the well-being of the economy and society around them. This is true in entrepreneurship as well. When we do continue to find that the way women entrepreneurs use investment dollars is very different than their male counterparts. They tend to hire more people. Their businesses employ more people, retain them for longer. They tend to have fewer absolute losses. They may not have as many huge wins. You may see fewer women unicorns, but you will see fewer women absolute failures along that way. And these two things combined are why we continue to see study after study show that companies that include women in leadership continue to outperform for their investors across all classes, but absolutely within the high growth sector as well.
And you think if, you know, I know that we need to change in terms of the venture culture and society, network, and the more they see that kind of result, you think even though it's still a very white man's world, will that convince them to invest more in an inclusive kind of companies?
Now, unfortunately, this is one of those areas that the facts cause, or seem to cause VCs to further entrench themselves or retrench themselves in their prior practices. I remember when we first started giving awards to VCs for their investment in women, and you know the highest it was, I think Tim Draper won the award the most times, and he had 25% of his portfolio had women CEOs, and he truly believed in the women he invested in. Actually, all investors believe in the women they invest in, but we stopped the awards for two reasons. One was the numbers were just not going the right direction, so you gotta stop giving awards when people just aren't earning them. So we stopped giving the awards. But the other reason we stopped giving the awards was we kept putting the data up there about the performance of these companies and how they were outperforming. And in parallel to that, venture was retracting. And we today are still at about 2% of venture capital being invested into women CEOs. And that's 20 years on. So we know these facts and we want to be armed with them. And certainly as investors ourselves, we use it to know how to assess companies' potential. And every time there's turnover in the C-suite of one of our startups, we make sure that women are in the pipeline to be considered for the executive team because we know that's going to improve the performance. But we kind of stopped lecturing about it because we were losing audience. And we think the better way to get venture audience, because that's ultimately what we want, right? VCs investing in this, was to allow them to invest alongside us. So we work really hard to get our deals in front of those firms that we see are aligned with the business success and aligned with our entrepreneurs' success. And we provide thought leadership. Don't get me wrong. You know, I'm doing this conversation with you. I'm sharing with you our learning. But it's very rare that today I will sit down with the VC to talk about performance of companies that include women, you know, because all those reports are out there, and all it's done is it's correlated to a lack in change in the market. So I just don't want to be part of that unchanging market. I'm working to change the market, and I'm going to do it through investment. And I'm going to do it while I sit on the boards of the companies that I invest in. And I'm going to look those male investors in the eye, and I'm going to be a peer to them, and they're going to see that a woman by their side has been part of the success. And a woman has sat on the board with them and been a board member. She's been productive and she's had thoughts. And that's our current change the world thesis, is we're just going to start to change it through our own investment behavior.
Yeah, no, that's a great tool that you have to make that change, I think. And kudos to a lot of your hard work. And it's important work that you're doing. And I'm glad that you are 20 years strong or young and keep evolving. And I think we all benefit when there's a lot more people participate in this innovation. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me, Christine. You take care and be well.
Okay, you too.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Health Technology Podcast. We want to thank our executive producer, Herminio Neto, our content writer, Casper Mossman, and our podcast engineer, Andrew Rojek. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave a review. The Health Technology Podcast is available on all major platforms.